Coming up on this week's show, play Game Boy Classics on your Switch.
A cheap CD-ROM drive for your Amiga.
And we chat about controversial games with Kirk Hume.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every week with our amazing friends at Bitmap Books. Now, they proudly present their biggest, most ambitious book yet, I'm Too Young to Die, The Ultimate Guide to First-Person Shooters, 1992 to 2002, covering the early experimental years of the genre that now rules the world, covering more than 180 games. You can check that out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our friends at PCBWay, now they offer a fully featured custom PCB prototype service, and they have low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards, and offer services like 3D printing and injection molding. And PCBWay are massive supporters of the retro community. So if you're working on a project right now, get an instant quote for it at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 365, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And it is our favourite time of the week, just before the weekend, when we get to completely geek out about all things retro, get all nostalgic, and of course bring you up to speed on all the happenings in the world of retro from over the last 7 days. And of course, in the second half of the podcast, that is where we welcome on an industry veteran to give us their story and talk about the classics that they worked on. And today, we've got a real treat. I can't believe that we finally got Kirk Ewing on the show.
I've got to have words with Joe here, you see, because I'm usually the guy that gets the guests, and Joe's just been killing it recently. So I feel that my crown is kind of slipping at the moment.
Yeah, I'm just doing my thing, dropping a few emails, contacting a few people. You know what it is? I started using LinkedIn, like, you know, for myself, for my, like, my regular, you know, weekday job, 9 till 5. And I've just started like adding loads of people on it and just dropping in messages. And most of the time, they're just like, yeah, drop me an email. And then they just come on. And I'm like, what's Ravi been messing about at?
Pull your finger out, boy.
I've got to get on it. Because this week's guest is just absolutely mind-blowing. You know, one of my favorite guests that we've had on and one of my favorite discussions that we've had on the entire show.
Yeah.
Now, Kirk has been he's involved in the video game industry for decades now. I mean, a lot of people in the UK will remember him from his appearances on Games Master.
Yes.
He was particularly in the last couple of series. I mean, he was kind of reviewing games in the early series, and then he became a bit more of a staple towards the end, including that episode where Dave Perry had the infamous Mario 64 incident. And I think, you know, we've had Dave Perry on the podcast before. We've had Dominic Diamond on. So we've got their sides of the story, but also, Kirk was on stage as well, wasn't he? So
we get Kirk's kind of side of it. But also, he went on and he did quite a chaotic show later on with Dominic Diamond, which was called Kirk's Night of Plenty.
Dom and Kirk's Night of Plenty.
Yeah, Dom and Kirk's Night of Plenty, which was just absolutely mad if you've not seen that. But within games development, you know, he was a director of games and he worked with Viz Entertainment. And man, Viz, they did like some wicked title. So they worked with Rockstar and they did State of Emergency, which was a fantastic, like, anarchistic kind of title where you're going around, you know, smashing up shops and property, and it's all kind of set in the future. And he also started working, you know, I think he had the rights to the GTA movie at one point that he was kind of going around and banding about. But then later on, he went into some pretty controversial titles as well. So we cover some controversial subjects in this, particularly JFK Reloaded, which was a game about the assassination of JFK.
Yeah, and that got, obviously, particularly in America, some very bad press from lots of high-profile politicians. And we kind of talk a bit about, you know, why he decided to make those games. But actually, he's got a really good angle on it, and also why he thinks, you know, they're actually quite educational games as well. And it's a really interesting side of it, because I think, you know, often we talk to people that make controversial games that really just do it to shock. But actually, there's a lot more to it than just that, isn't there, with Kirk?
Yeah. There was, like, a lot of looking back at history. And, of course, being on the edge of Rockstar, you know, they've always had a bit of controversy with, like, the original GTA series and stuff like that. So it all kind of plays into that. And it's a really interesting conversation.
And even today, he's working on a competitor to the Meta Quest, a new augmented reality headset that we'll talk a bit about as well. So really interesting guy. Kirk Ewing, he's going to be our special guest on the show in just over half an hour from now. Now, it has been a busy week in terms of retro gaming, and I do apologise, guys, if I do sound slightly distracted because on my desk in front of me, yeah, I must admit, I have been playing it. Game Boy games. Now on the Switch and Game Boy Advance.
Yeah, man. So this was announced. There was the Nintendo Direct last week, or maybe the week before now, about a week and a half ago. We're slow to the mark on this one. But
Joe was hungover in Budapest.
Still a little bit hungover, I'm not going to lie. But yeah, there was a lot of big announcements. Metroid Prime on the Switch was a big one. But the one what we've been excited about is the release of the Game Boy and Game Boy Advance titles as part of the... The library they've got there on the Nintendo Online. It's part of the premium library. So, when you pay the extra and you get the N64 and the Mega Drive / Genesis games, you now also get the Game Boy and Game Boy Advance games on there. And they've released already out to play about 8 games per system, with another 8 on the way, 4 per system as well. But it's a really nice mixed library. Of course, Tetris is there on the Game Boy one. But anything else you've been playing, Dan, or anything else you can spot there, some standout titles?
Well, I'm looking through the Game Boy Advance list as well, and you've got Super Mario Brothers 3 is on here as well. You've got WarioWare Inc. on there too. Mario Kart Super Circuit, which is a really good version, actually. Big fan of that. You've got Zelda on there as well, the Minish Cap. Although it seems like, I'm looking through my library here, some of them seem to be... doubled up. Oh, so you got the European version and the Japanese version of a lot of them as well.
Yeah, so you get both versions of them. Quite often they'll do that, Nintendo. But some really, really, really standout games. So the Game Boy, you've got Alone in the Dark, The New Nightmare, Game & Watch Gallery 3, which was the Game & Watch games, like in one cartridge.
Because you can do Game Boy Color as well, can't you? Yeah. So Alone in the Dark ones are color
games. Yeah. Gargoyle's Quest, Kirby's Dream Land, The Legend of Zelda Link's Awakening DX Deluxe, so that was the Game Boy Color version of Link's Awakening. Metroid 2, Return of Samus, Super Mario Land 2, 6 Golden Coins, which my friend's been messaging me about that he's been playing through. I've not had a chance to get on it yet. Of course, Tetris, Wario Land 3, and then, like you say, you've got Legend of Zelda Minish Cap, Mario & Luigi Super Saga, Mario Kart Super Circuit, loads of really awesome games. But it's just a shame that it's taken, 5-6 years?
Yeah,
for them to do this.
We mentioned ages ago that it should be on, didn't we? And it made complete sense to get Game Boy games on a handheld.
It's pretty obvious, having, as you said, handheld, having their kind of older legacy handheld titles on there. Obviously it was all virtual console before, but they're now charging individually for each one, so they're probably going to make a bit more money. I'm wondering...
Well, it's a subscription you pay, subscription, actually.
So
it's not
it's like Game Pass or something.
Nintendo Online, it's got 2 tiers. I forget how much it is, but the bottom tier gets you Nintendo and Super Nintendo games. You get about 20 on each, don't you, Dan?
Yeah.
And you get your Mega Drive games too. Modern console world, so I don't know about these subscription things. But I was wondering, is that also, are they going to do their whole handheld legacy? Because if they do that, then they're going to have the Virtual Boy in there. Have they got the DS?
Would that work on the Switch, the Virtual Boy? Because it's quite a unique screen it's got on there. I'm not sure what they look like.
You got to hold the Switch right against your face.
You get an adapter, the DS, have they got any DS titles on there?
No. So as far as they've got so far, for the uninitiated, Ravi, is, like I say, we've got the Nintendo, they've got the Super Nintendo, they've got the N64, which was only last year, I think, maybe the year before, Sega Mega Drive, and now they've introduced Game Boy and Game Boy Advance. So that would mean the Game Boy Advance is actually the most modern system they've got on there. So I guess the next would be the GameCube and the DS. So, I don't, whether they do that or not, there's a lot of people crying out for the GameCube. Not so much the Virtual Boy, but I think it would be funny if they did that.
I think DS might be hard with the 2 screens, or maybe they could do something with... having the Switch screen and then having it on the television.
Yeah.
Or if you held the Switch vertically, it might work.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Maybe.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. I still think the Switch is going to be a complete failure, and it's just
Robbie's prediction when the Switch launched like what 5 years ago. But yeah, I mean, in terms of, you know, these online retro catalogs that they keep introducing, and I mean, I think, you know, when Nintendo Switch Online launched, it was only about £20 for a year, and I've looked now because I mean, like all of these services, I sign up on direct debit, it just gets renewed, and you're not really sure what it's kind of crept up to. At the moment, a 12-month plan in the UK, £31.49 for 12 months.
You know it's the creep, isn't it, right? Like, you look at Game Pass, I remember there was like a deal where it's like £1 on the PC or something. But
and everyone signed up.
Yeah, it's like now even, I noticed my Netflix membership has started getting more expensive, and then they're talking about like, oh, well, we may have a few adverts in there at one tier or something, and it's like slowly the kind of creep starts happening once they get you on one of these online services.
But in terms of Nintendo Switch, I mean, you know, £31 for 12 months, I think, is definitely, it's a lot cheaper than Game Pass or PSN.
I'd like to see is a physical adapter that would somehow go onto the Switch that you could put the older titles in, but that probably wouldn't happen.
You're dreaming there, Avi.
But it does just prove to me, and I mean, I love the fact that Nintendo are doing this, and yeah, it does feel long overdue, you know, that the GameCube just makes complete sense to have on a handheld. And whether they'll get around to doing, like, you know, DS games and that on there at some point, wouldn't surprise me if they find a way. But it really does just cement the fact that the Switch just feels like the ultimate kind of retro console now, doesn't it?
It's for me, like, when I was younger and the DS came out and everything, I saw it as the evolution of the Game Boy. It was part of the Game Boy. I was like, I used to call it the Game Boy DS. Like, but obviously it isn't the Game Boy DS. It was the DS. It wasn't part of that line. But in a way, in my head, even though the Switch is, you know, it's Nintendo's main console, they combine the two, you know, I still kind of see it as like, it's the Game Boy, you know, like the Game Boy is its granddad. I don't see it as like the Nintendo is its granddad. Do you know what I mean? So I think it 100% makes sense to get them on there. And, you know, it's good to see that they're already announcing games that are going to come out later this year as well on them.
Yeah, and every time I open like one of the emulators on there, you know, if I haven't played it for a couple of weeks, there's always a bunch of new titles that they're putting in there like all the time. So in terms of value, I think, you know, it's really good and a really simple way to play them. And that's the thing. It's like, you know, if you're emulating these titles on your PC or something, or Raspberry Pi, something like that, you're not sure they're going to run very well and there might be emulation glitches. You know, Nintendo always do it really well.
Yeah, my one question is, though, you know, maybe in 10 or 20 years when they're onto the next console, when does this service then get shut off?
Wow,
there
is
we lose all the titles, you know, so I'm still always a bit of a fan of physicality.
That's when the Switch emulation comes to
I'm emulating the Switch on my new Nintendo console so I can play Game Boy Advance.
Yeah, that'll be it. So if you have got a Nintendo Online subscription, those Game Boy and Game Boy Advance games are available now. Now, we also love seeing fan remakes as well, and I must admit this one does make me a little bit nervous because we often talk about how Nintendo are not all that friendly towards fan-related projects, but it turns out Sega have been a little bit like that over the last couple of months, so remains to be seen kind of where this is going to go. But this is really cool. This is a Sonic 3D Blast remake by a fan.
Yeah, so this fan's remaking Sonic Blast, whatever you want to call it, Sonic Blast, Sonic 3D, Flicker's Island, Sonic 3D, I just call it, you know, the last one for the Mega Drive, the one that came out on Mega Drive and Sega Saturn. But this user is remaking it. They're called White Feather. And they're quite known kind of in like the Sonic kind of modding community, known as Sega Sonic Saturn on Twitter as well. And they've posted a couple of videos about this. They've been working on this for about a year now, but they've just done some recent updates on it. And this is essentially a fully 3D remake of Sonic 3D Blast. I'm going to keep calling it 3D Blast, but Sonic 3D, I always knew it as. And it looks really nice. I can't help but think it looks like what we should have got for the Sega Saturn.
Oh, like, yeah, you know, in the can of worms there.
Yeah, a massive can of worms there. But yeah, completely built from the ground up, but they've recreated it really well. Well, I'm not too sure if you guys are familiar with Sonic 3D.
It felt like Marble Madness. Sonic like stuck in the middle of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good way to put it. Yeah, it's like that funny isometric view and you've got to save the flickies, the little birds. I think what we've seen so far of this, you know, they've captured that really well. And even like the running animation that he's got quite a funny running animation in Sonic 3D, and they've actually captured that quite well. in this remake.
It's kind
3D
of like skating along, sliding along. I remember getting some of the angles on the jumps was really hard on that. So I'm glad to see they've got a camera that you can actually change positions on.
Yeah, and then, you know, they've obviously, you know, modernized it as well. You can, you know, play it in 16:9 ratio, aspect ratio, and they've redone some of the mixing of the music as well using some of the Saturn mixers, which is really cool. But I just think it's got a really nice Sega Saturn kind of maybe early Dreamcast look to it. As Dan says, you know, maybe he was talking about it, it's not a very good thing for the design.
Well, what wasn't the Saturn where everyone was kind of desperate for the Sonic game and then they brought Sonic Jam out, which was just to kind of like remake and look at some photos and run around that island. Yeah.
And Sonic R the Racer as well was on there, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, wasn't there a version of 3D Blast as well that kind of came out a while ago that was a weird, totally different like beta?
Yeah, that rings a bell. I think we covered that when there was, you know, one of those big dumps about a year ago. I think we did cover the beta version of Sonic 3D.
Yeah, it was like a show version or something that came out beforehand. Yeah, so this is based on the actual released version.
Yeah, this is based on the actual release. This isn't like a based on a demo that never came out or anything like that, or something that was seen at, you know, at E3 or anything like that in the 90s. This is completely from the ground up, and you know, it looks really nice. Apparently there's going to be original voice work in it. They've redesigned, done some really nice 3D rendered images for like cut scenes at the start of the game and stuff like that, because of the 3D blast that we did get did have these kind of like rendered images. And so they've incorporated some, you know, homemade ones of that as well, which, you know, looked like they're straight out of the game. I kind of had to like double take it and be like, is that from the actual Mega Drive game? But they're not, you know, they're new ones that they've inserted, and, you know, the music sounds really gorgeous on it as well. So we'll just see where it goes with how funny Sega have been in the last couple of months.
Because that game was developed by Traveller's Tales,
wasn't
it? Yeah,
it was, yeah.
And that's the thing, because, I mean, I didn't play that game until quite a bit later, but I do have vivid memories of it coming out, but also people, you know, being a fan of it on the Mega Drive, thinking it was an impressive kind of demo, if you like, on the Mega Drive, but being bitterly disappointed when it came out on the Saturn that it wasn't a proper 3D Sonic game. So I think it's always kind of got that kind of reputation around it.
Yeah.
You know, the people like, we don't want this. We want actual proper Sonic 3D. So I think in terms of reception at the time, I do vividly remember quite a bit of disappointment around it. But I haven't played it enough to say whether
or not
it's a good game. I
remember the feeling of playing that when I was a kid, that I couldn't get enough speed up. And whenever I got enough speed, I hit something that would then slow me down. And I always felt this didn't have the kind of, you know, pace that Sonic usually had in games. And that frustrated me a bit,
Yeah, it was kind of going back to what you said a few minutes ago as well. It was very slippery in it as well, and the perspectives and stuff. And, you know, as you say, Dan, it was made by Traveller's Tale. And famously, it was built off, you know, the Sonic team just kind of gave them a concept and said, this is what we want the game to be like. And they kind of had to make it off the back of the concept of it, while Team Sonic were meant to be making like the mainline Sega Saturn release. And, you know, we don't want to open that kind of worms and everything.
That never happened, obviously.
And, you know, we only ended up with Sonic 3D and the weird Sonic Jam and Sonic R and stuff like that until eventually we got Sonic Adventure. And then there's the weird Sonic arcade game as well, Sonic the Fighters, that not many people seem to talk about. The less said about that, the better, probably. But yeah, we'll see where this goes.
In terms of a time capsule, I think, you know, when this came out, like 96, didn't it, originally? It's an interesting look back at kind of what was going on in gaming back then. I mean, everything had to be 3D, didn't it, you know, around that time. So it's nice to see some fan attention and that game getting some love. So if you want to get hold of that, it is coming out for the PC. And there is a work in progress alpha version now. And I'll put a link to that article in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, one of the most legendary adventure games of all time, this is always nice to see, is getting a physical re-release for the PC and the NES, and this is the legendary Maniac Mansion.
Yeah, this is an absolutely groundbreaking title. You know, the Scum Engine was actually kind of developed with this because Oh, what does SCUM stand for again?
I think it was Script Creation Utility for Maniac Mansion.
Yeah, there you go.
I love that. Oh, I think it was this guy's.
just off his head straight away.
Yeah, I've got a feeling that was a question in one of the Christmas quizzes that's embedded in my mind.
Well, we had David Fox on the podcast, and you know, he talked about this title and how big it was. And to be honest, it's one of the titles that I've not visited myself, and I'd love to go back and actually look and play at it. But I know it was groundbreaking, especially with like the humour and the kind of B-movie setting that they had on it.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, I kind of got into the LucasArts games with Monkey Island 1 and Loom around that time. And obviously, Maniac Mansion predated those by a couple of years. Yeah. I think it was, what, 87, I've got a feeling, came out. I have played it, you know, kind of retrospectively in the last decade or so. On the Commodore 64 was actually the version that I've played the most. And I think just having that running on an 8-bit system with that kind of point and click interface is always quite impressive. But yeah, this is really cool. So this is at Limited Run Games, who, of course, they do a lot of this thing, don't they? Where, you know, where they actually do real collector's items, don't they? And present them beautifully, and you know, the real premium products as well. And there's going to be three different options that is actually available from today to pre-order.
Oh, okay. I thought it was just the two, but yeah, there's going to be the Nintendo option. Which obviously comes with the NES version of the game.
Yeah, the standard and premium editions on the NES. Oh, okay. And then you've got the collector's one for the PC as well, by the looks
of it. Yeah. And, you know, like you say, you get the standard version, which comes with the physical cartridge, you know, that you can play on NES. And I think that's going to be $60, whereas the premium version is going to be $100, $99.99, which does add, you know, a bunch of other stuff. You know, there's going to be like, there's a map in there and like a pin. Like enamel pin. It's limited run, you know, you get the big presentation of it.
Yeah.
But it's the PC version that I think looks really cool. You know, I love the big box PC games, which obviously you just don't really get anymore. Unfortunately, it doesn't actually come on floppy disks or anything like that. It does come on a USB stick, but it is a cool USB stick. I've not played Maniac Mansion, but it's like a little blue mummy figurine, which I assume is part of the game.
Like a pharaoh kind of
thing. Yeah, a little pharaoh kind of thing. Which does look really cool. Now, I believe the PC version is going to be a port of the, I think it is the C64 version. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting because they had different developers for the different titles. So LucasArts Films did the NES version, but also Jalico as well did. Okay. I think it was the Japanese version as well. So there's like a mix of developers when they're releasing it on the console, but then obviously PC, it was... It was, you know, straight away Lucasfilm. I can never say that.
Lucasfilm Games.
Yeah, then straight away it was, you know, Lucasfilm Games.
And obviously, I mean, in terms of adventure games, one of the most famous adventure games ever released. And I haven't played it for a few years. I mean, it would be interesting to kind of see. I'm not sure whether it doesn't look like there's kind of any updated graphics or anything in this. It is literally just the original
just
game, isn't it?
The original games, yeah.
That's what Limited Run do, though. I mean, they're not about doing the remasters.
Yeah. And, you know, the price, it's interesting. The premium one is about $100.
Yeah.
And then you've got about $60 for the NES.
Yeah.
And $74 for the PC. So it's kind of expensive, but you're getting a lot of things with it as well. And that's always
the
case.
And like the title says, it is Limited Run, isn't it? They're not making millions.
Yeah, they tend to limit to it. It doesn't actually say on this article here, but they tend to limit it between 1,000 and 3,000 Limited Run do. Mm. And then you always get like, it will say on the back of the box what number you've got, and you'll get a little card in there to say what number you've got as well, which is, you know, it's always really nice. I've got a couple of Limited Run games myself, and I've not actually brought myself to open them. I've kept them sealed, which I know just sounds really silly because I've bought them.
I bet no one does. I bet everybody just keeps them on a shelf.
Yeah, probably, more than likely. I've got the Castlevania collection and the Zombies Ate My Neighbors collections, and they're just sealed on my shelf.
Yeah,
you know, just there, ready for me to be buried with when I die.
So if you're a fan of the classic point-and-click adventure games, a really nice presentation pack for collectors. Pre-order's available from today when the show comes out, February 17th, up until April the 2nd. So I'll put a link to that. And everything else we talk about, you find it all in your podcast app or the show notes at theretrohour.com. And while we're talking about theretrohour.com, that is a good little place to head along to if you'd like to offer a little bit of support to this podcast. Because just to mention, we don't talk about it that often. We have a patron, and we do quite a lot for our patrons as well, because we do an extra podcast called The Retro Hour After Hours. So this is a bonus podcast, comes out every single month, and I think we just recorded the 31st episode of that a couple of weeks ago. And if you join us on Patreon as a gold member or above, you will unlock the entire back catalogue. You can listen to 31 episodes, some of which are like 2 hours long, and the latest one is a really good one, because so many times of us doing this podcast over the years, I hear people going, What's that Joe Fox guy about? Well, he's not even an Amiga fan. Is he not trying to make... You need to get him into the Amiga. And we finally did it, didn't we? We got you on an Amiga to play some games.
I'm not going to lie, guys. I think people are more interested in to hear what your guys' favourite Amiga games are. Because you two are just like Amiga through and through. Like, I give my opinion on it. I tell you what games I
bleed Amiga.
But you guys bleed Amiga. You literally do.
Well, you cut Ravi, there's boing balls all the way through.
Well, looking at the kind of themes of the recent one that we've had, we got Joe on like a system he doesn't know. So I think we should all do a system that we don't know. I was chatting with Joe earlier and I was saying, wouldn't it be cool if like I did something like, you know, played the Turbo Graphics and then like, you know, Dan,
play the Switch, Ravi.
Dan did some like Casio stuff or something. Yeah, the Switch would be a new system for me. Yeah. But, you know, look at a Total Alien system. I think that'd make a really, really fun episode.
Well, that's the thing about the After Hours. I mean, anything goes, doesn't it? We do different themes every single month, and you know, hopefully you enjoy it. We do get some nice feedback on that. So if you want to unlock all those episodes, that's available now. Next weekend, obviously February's a short month, so it will be the patrons hangout coming up on Sunday 26th. This is where we get a load of us together, as many patrons as want to come on. We hang out for a couple of hours on a Sunday night, just geek out as well. And you get the normal episode early when I can get it edited in time. You get extra patrons news, sometimes 10, 15 minutes extra on every episode as well. So a really good time to join us on Patreon, and all the details to sign up right now are at theretrohour.com. So we're going to talk to this week's special guest, Kirk Ewing, in just a moment, talking about classic controversial games, a few Games Master memories as well. And speaking of being slightly controversial, the Intellivision Amico. Now, have you guys watched DJ Slope's video on this? This is like
I don't think I've had the time to watch
it. I was going
to
say, but find also me 4 hours and I'll watch it.
Talking of Earthworm Jim as well, Kirk, who we interviewed, does talk about Earthworm Jim 3D, which he did some stuff on. So interesting to hear this story about the new Earthworm Jim title.
Well, this was something that we talked about on the show years ago when the original Intellivision Amico announcement happened. And if you want to get the full story of that, like I said, Slopes has done an incredible video. And I've been driving about an hour and a half to work each way this week and last week. So I've had about 3 hours in the car at stupid o'clock in the morning. So literally, I put YouTube on my Bluetooth on my car, just been listening to it on the speakers. Great video he's done, going really in-depth into the whole Intellivision Amico story. Way too long for us to obviously recap everything here. But really, I mean, the reason we're talking about Earthworm Jim 4 is this was a game that was originally announced as an exclusive for the Intellivision Amico console.
I would say it was probably the biggest title for that whole console. Yeah. They were going to run with that as their kind of killer app, weren't they?
Yeah, there was even videos as well, wasn't there? So it looked like, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the Intellivision Amico and is it vaporware and, you know, a lot of doubts over whether it's ever going to materialize. But there was a teaser trailer that came out about 3 years ago now that I remember us getting pretty excited about when, you know, it first dropped, because I'm looking now for it on YouTube. It turns out it's been deleted. The graphics look nice in it from memory, but it was just Jim kind of crash landing on a beach and then running around, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was really the thing that got people excited, because obviously Earthworm Jim, legendary franchise, and this is going to be a new game only on this console. And so that got a lot of interest.
You've got the original artist and creator of Earthworm Jim, Doug Tenapel, to actually, you know, be part of it and get involved in that project. So it did seem like, you know, something interesting was going to happen, and he was putting like concept art on Instagram as well and stuff. But it does look like it's kind of hit the dirt and kind of collapsed after the collapse of the foot spa Amico.
Yeah, it does look a bit like a foot spa. But yeah, this comes from a website called Out of Context Earthworm Jim. It was actually a Twitter feed as well. And there's been a Discord conversation apparently, and I think this comes from either someone who's close to it, It doesn't actually say what the source is here in this article, but basically it says there was a Discord conversation where it says Earthworm Jim 4 was quietly dusted under the carpet, hoping nobody would notice. And they reckon that it could even be, you know, speculation around the fact that maybe Intellivision didn't have the rights to Earthworm Jim because it's owned by Interplay as well.
You know, if something's been in development and, like, I think if anything could have broken out of the kind of Amico and come out of it at the end, it would have been this. You know, as a project where they could have gone, right, we're just going to continue going and then we're going to launch it or port it onto a different platform. And then it could have just gone ahead as Earthworm Jim 4 and they, like, dropped the Amico. But it seems like it was so kind of integrated with the stuff that happened there, and probably, I guess, the funding around it would have been a based on that. And yeah, that's all just quite completely gone. But to me, it seems like one of those titles that could just branch out, you know.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, that's what I expected to happen. So I thought, yeah, obviously the Amico doesn't look like it's ever going to get released, but it would make sense that, you know, they would just port this game to the Switch or something if they had rights to it. Because I think it would be a big seller if they put it out on those platforms.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of nostalgia about the series. A lot of people love it.
Out of everything that's happened with the Amico and everything, it would have been nice to have still seen this ported to, like, Xbox or Switch or whatever. You know, I think it would have been perfect for the Switch.
You know, it's interesting, though, because after watching or listening to Slope's video, don't watch YouTube and drive, only listen, I do kind of want an Intellivision Amico.
you're a sucker for, like, failed systems.
Put it next to your VCS, eh?
Yeah.
I know, it's really weird.
I was listening to Retro Asylum the other day, and great podcast, and they said, Dan Wood is one of the only people that we know with a VCS.
And I think there are some Amicos out there because, I mean, they've been seen at shows and stuff as well. And I was wondering this because I think there was actually a video I saw some guy kind of unboxing one. So there are definitely, like, you know, models of them out there that I think are working. And I thought, you know, if you got one of those in a box and if it does never materialize, they're going to be worth a fair bit of it, aren't they, as collectors
items? Put an Amico inside a VCS case and then you've got the rarest console in the world.
I bet there'll be, like, fan recreations of the Amico in the future in retro a bit. So, yeah, it looks like Earthworm Jim at the moment. Looks like it may never materialise, but I don't think many people had their breaths held anyway after the news over the last couple of months.
Yeah, I hope, I don't know how it worked with the crowdfunding and stuff, but I hope people haven't, like, lost money on the Amico.
Oh, I think they may have.
Like the public and the backers, yeah.
Yeah.
If that's happened, then that's really bad.
Yeah, I know that Slope said he had, like, £100 kind of invested in it that he doesn't expect to see again. But if you haven't watched Slope's video, actually, like I said, it's 4 hours. It's the most in-depth video you'll ever see about the Intellivision Amico.
Might have to.
And he's very open as well. He was a bit of a supporter about it originally, you know, and he, like I said, he backed it. So there's a bit of egg on his face as well, and he's quite open about all that too. And I think, you know, the best video I've ever seen from Slope. So I'll definitely stick that in the show notes if you want to hear more about that. Now, just one quick thing to mention before we chat to this week's special guest, Kirk Ewan, coming up in a second. This is something I've been playing around with over the last couple of weeks. And being, you know, gamers of a certain age, I don't know about you, Ravi, in particular, does the word CD-ROM still sound futuristic and a bit exciting to you?
CD-ROM. totally. I remember that. I think it's Tomorrow's World where they got it on and they were, like, scratching it with nails and they were like, this will never get damaged. This is a CD-ROM, you know.
Was that where they ate baked beans off it or something?
Something like that, I still remember the introduction of it. But this is a new way of having a CD-ROM on your Amiga, which is pretty cool, actually, because with the CD-ROM, I remember when it came out, you know, people would try and come up with these solutions and I think Scuzzy Squirrel was one where you'd have it stuck in the side. Another one was cutting your Amiga to pieces, having a CD-ROM, like, rammed inside that you'd then press a button and it would, like, fire out of the wedge case.
Should I tell you how I did mine back in the day? I'm not sure whether you had, because I had an Amiga 1200 and I wanted a CD-ROM drive on there. So it probably got to around 96, 97. And that was when CD-ROM drives, you know, IDE CD-ROM drives were becoming affordable. I think I bought, like, a quad speed or an 8 speed for, like, you know, 60, 70 quid. So I had an IDE cable.
A buffered IDE interface with a cable coming off,
Yeah, and one cable going to my hard disk, one kind of snaking out the side of my Amiga 1200 without any screws in the case so it could come out the back. And then I had it lying, just the naked CD-ROM drive on my table. And then I spliced into the floppy drive power cable soldered on some extra wires so I could run a Molex cable to the back of the CD-ROM drive, and I had this whole mess.
These mess kind of Frankenstein setups. You see, that's why people put them in the towers or had the big boxes, because you could hide all the mess inside it. But I do remember those days, and you think, oh, I'm so futuristic. But now there's a quite neat solution that you've been using, Dad.
Yeah, well, this is a new driver written by Aidan Holmes that is uploaded to the Amiga software repository called Aminet. And this is basically a driver that allows you to use very cheap PCMCIA CD-ROM drives. And the ones in particular are the Sony VAIO drives.
Okay.
And there's a couple of different ones that are supported. And I got one off eBay for £15. And it is so easy. I mean, you
guaranteed think prices are going to go up now. This has been introduced. But yeah, I can imagine there's a lot around, you know.
I posted on one of the Amiga community groups, and a lot of people are like, oh, I've just bought one now, and I'm going to try and get a YouTube video made about it if I can get off my bum and make a new video. But yeah, I think you're right. There's going to be more interest in this now this drive is available. But it works really well, and it is. Basically, it looks a bit like a CD Walkman from the early 2000s.
Pretty cool.
Really small and light, you know, compared to those massive CD-ROM drives that we had in the 90s. And plugs at the side of my Amiga 1200. You download this driver. I've also got, because I want to run CD32 games on it as well, even though I've got like two CD32s. And that Joe asked me the other day when I was showing a few pictures. He's like, so hang on, what was a CD32 just an Amiga 1200 with a CD-ROM drive?
Kind of, but with a fancy chip called the Akiko that no one used. But one thing that happened with CD-ROM, and that was always the audio would be played through the CD-ROM player and kind of not through the Amiga, so it'd be disconnected. So what is the solution? How are you mixing the audio then between your Amiga and the CD-ROM? Because you had to physically mix it back in the day. I do remember some people with cables that you'd have a resistor on, and there'd be all sorts of kind of weird mixes, and the volume would dip and all of this kind of stuff.
Yeah, you're right, because when you're playing generally CD32 games, you get the Amiga sound effects come out of the Amiga's audio ports, and then there's usually CD music that's streaming off the CD as well. And if you have, like, you know, CD32, that combines them all itself, you know, just out of one port, so you don't need to mess around with it. But this, I actually got a little mini mixer that's a tiny little thing about the size of half the size of a TV remote control, which is a little audio mixer.
Nice solution.
And it's got these little so basically I ran a mini jack to phono cable into that for the CD audio, two phono cable out of my Amiga 1200 into that as well, and then the output of it into my monitor, so you can manually control the volume of the CD and the sound effects as well. So actually it works really well, and I think actually it's quite nice having manual control over it, because some games the CD audio kind of drowns out the sound effects.
That was always the problem. I remember when I had mine like hacked together, and I'd be playing it, and the sound effects like guns and explosions would be huge, and the music in the background, I wanted to hear it, so I'd have to absolutely blast it up, and it would just like, all the levels would be totally wrecked. So that's quite a nice solution.
Yeah, so hopefully, like I said, I'm hopefully going to do a YouTube video on it at some point. I think my last video was in September. It's been a while, but it's working really well. I've got it on my desk near me now. So a really cheap and tidy way of attaching a CD-ROM drive to users old, even like, you know, the old CD-PD and Aminet collections and stuff like that, and the old magazine cover CDs. You know, there's a load of old CD-ROMs to explore.
Or just now, that's what I call music. That's what you want to play.
CDs playing through your monitor is quite nice. It's available now on Aminet for free, and that works with the Amiga 600 and the 1200, so I'll put that in our show notes too. Right, then we're going to be talking to Kirk Ewing, Controversial Games, in just a moment. Before we do that, we're going to talk about languages. And we're talking about languages that we like to learn to improve our lives, because this is our sponsor, our good friends at Babbel. You guys got some holiday booked in this year? You heading away anywhere?
I booked Tenerife yesterday for May.
Yeah.
Señor, gracias.
I'm doing an Amiga event in the UK, so I'm going to be staying at home this year.
But I'm sure you'll have people from all different countries coming over to the Amiga event in the UK. And that's the thing about us Brits when we go abroad. I mean, generally, we're not really that well known for being versed in other languages. We are a bit lazy, if I'm honest, when we go abroad. You know, you just kind of expect everyone else to speak English. But I don't know about you guys. I always try and make an effort to learn a few phrases and that kind of thing. But often I get quite embarrassed.
It's usually like alcohol, toilet, food. Yeah. Those are the three phrases I go for, yeah.
on holiday. But I mean, I don't know if you guys are the same. Sometimes if you go to like Spain or somewhere and you see like, you know, tourists from France or Germany, you know, they're often speaking the native languages, and you think it would be nice if we made a bit more of an effort in this country. And we were talking about it last week, the fact that I think our school system, particularly when we were at school, it was just never very successful, was it? You learned just, you know, words rather than phrases. And that's a good thing about Babbel. Now, Babbel is something that you can use on your phone or your computer. It basically makes language learning quick, and it focuses on natural conversation. And the way it works is it gives you 15-minute lessons. So, you know, you're not there. You remember being at school. I think I did like French lessons at school for like 3 hours on a Monday afternoon, which is like no wonder things didn't sink in back then. But the way these are designed is to be efficient and effective and to help you learn a new language. And the lessons are crafted by over 150 language experts. So it's real people. And you'll learn how to have real-world conversations, stuff that you will use when you go on holiday, not those meaningless phrases that you learnt at school. And they're also voiced by native speakers as well, using modern conversation methods as well. So you're not going to sound stuffy or, you know, like it's out of a 1970s textbook. And their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective across multiple studies. And you can pick from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, German. And what I think is really cool is Babbel has got speech recognition technology. So I don't know about you guys, you know, when you're learning languages at school and stuff, you didn't quite know if you're pronouncing things properly and how your accent sounds.
No, yeah, there's a lot of like regional dialects with stuff.
Yeah.
I think I remember one. The only one that we knew well was the song, which was like, Jean de Valoerte. And that's like stuck in my head.
Well, maybe you could sing that to Babbel, Ravi, and it'll rate your accent and your pronunciation. So they do have speech recognition that can help you improve your pronunciation. And there are so many ways to learn as well. I mean, they've got lessons, there's podcasts, games, videos. You can even join in live classes with a language teacher as well. So you can start your new language learning journey with our friends at Babbel. And because we love their service, we've actually got you a great offer where you can get 3 months free with a purchase of a 3 month subscription by using our promo code RETRO. So sign up right now, head to this website, babbel.com/podcast23, and use the promo code RETRO for 3 months free. BABBEL.com/podcast23. Use our promo code RETRO, and a big thanks to our friends at Babbel, language learning that works. Right then, next, it's time to talk to this week's special guest and a really fun episode this week with Kirk Ewing. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest. And what a guest we've got this week. Someone who's worked in the industry for several decades now and is still doing very exciting things, going up against the big tech companies in America. So we'll talk more about that a bit later on as well. Let's welcome on someone who's a games director, a presenter, a designer as well. You know him from TV shows like Games Master, that used to be on back in the day as well. Let's welcome on our guest this week, Kirk Ewing. How are you doing, Kirk?
Hey, guys. Thanks very much for having me on. Very nice to meet you both.
Yeah, you too. Appreciate you taking the time at the end of your long work day to reminisce a bit with us today.
That's okay. I've had a nap today, so I'm feeling pretty good.
Yeah. Little siesta. Well, I mean, before we get into, you know, some of the history of, you know, what you've worked on in the games industry and what you're doing today, I mean, kind of winding it all the way back to day one. I mean, do you remember what kind of initially got you into gaming and that? I mean, where did your journey kind of start?
I know clearly where my journey started. I used to go, my grandpa was really quite sick when I was a kid, and I used to go with my mum to when she would look after him, and she would jump me at the arcade. So I'd get left at the arcade down at the front in Largs, and I saw my first ever arcade games machine, Space Invaders. And then along came Gorf. I don't know if you remember Gorf, the first sort of talking arcade machine that I ever got back to. And that was it for me. Basically, I was like, I like this. This is kind of the thing for me. And then I didn't do anything about that. Obviously, you think games are just, you know, not really a job. I didn't do anything about that for years. But I started, I think, again with the Amiga. And when I started really using the Amiga, I was completely hooked. It was the days of pirating discs, if you might remember. So you got
X-Copy Pro.
So you got a chance to play absolutely everything that got made. And at that point, I was pretty much, this is the job for me from this now on.
Well, was that your first machine that you got at home then, the Amiga?
No, I had a ZX81 and I had an Atari, which I borrowed from a mate and never gave back. And then really the Amiga was the one after that, yeah. So that was my first proper home machine. It was the one I fell in love with. It was completely broken. We used to have it outside the case, and you have to do that thing where you have to flex the machine just to get it in the right spot, and then you can load the disc quickly and hope it worked.
Yeah, I was wondering, did you then create any games yourself or design anything?
Well, I'm not a programmer, so I was kind of always about the kind of creative ideas. And yeah, I mean, I was designing ideas, but more importantly, I was staying with a guy called Jamie, and Jamie was a really early sort of 3D artist. And I was more kind of working with him, helping build some animations at the start and selling them to people. So my first real sort of experience of working in computers was helping him out before I actually got into the design.
And were you doing stuff on the Amiga, like, you know, messing around in Deluxe Paint and that kind of 100%, thing?
100%, yeah. And the earliest sort of 3D software as well. I mean, and it was where I saw things like Lemmings, right? You know, and again, to understand then that there was a Scottish company that was making this massive title and everybody was playing it, that really kind of inspired me to think, well, it is possible to go out there and do something else.
I think that's one thing about the Amiga as well. It really kind of fostered that creative feel, didn't it? Because, I mean, you had stuff like, I remember, like, Amos on there and Shoot 'Em Up Construction Kit. And, you know, I had friends that had Mega Drives and that, but literally you put a cartridge in, you played a game. On the Amiga, it felt like, you know, kind of anyone could do it, even though I know that it was a lot more involved making a game like Lemmings, but it did kind of give you the tools to do it at home, didn't it?
No, 100%. And it really, you know, that kind of experimentation that happened with the Amiga and the fact that it was still a slightly illegitimate bedroom thing, I think, was really important in fostering the stuff that I went on to do. So it did feel that we were, you know, punks, if you like, on the Amiga and about to do something unpleasant with it.
Well, what was that, like, DMA Designs Connections and VIS as well, or VIS there? Was it kind of made up of old staff from there?
The way that I met DMA Design and Dave Jones was actually through making a documentary about piracy. So as I'd mentioned previously, I was not at the forefront, but I was involved in the disc swapping scene, as we like to call it in Glasgow. And I decided that I would make a documentary film about it. And I approached Scottish Television, as it was at the time, and got a commission to make a short form documentary. And I actually went and got Dominic Diamond as the host for that documentary. And the two of us pitched up at DMA and interviewed Dave Jones, interviewed the hackers, interviewed a whole bunch of people for the documentary. So not only did I get my introduction to Dave and the games industry proper, but also it was the first time that I'd met Dominic in one package.
Right. What's that documentary called then? Is it still out there to watch anywhere? That sounds really interesting.
It's out there on YouTube somewhere. It's called Fair Game. And right. It's one of Dominic's early serious television forays.
Because it sounds like, you know, you mentioned being kind of in the cracking and, you know, the disc swapping scene as it was then. I mean, I was talking on our podcast a couple of weeks ago that I had an uncle who had a friend at work who used to dial all the pirate bulletin boards, you know, like Skid Row and Fairlight and all those.
No,
and
the names are flooding back.
Yeah, I mean, where did you kind of get your games from then, do you remember?
Where did I get my games from?
Yeah.
Well, the Barra's was the hotspot of GameSwap at the time, and the Barra's is this sort of notorious market in East End of Glasgow, with lots of sort of little stalls all hidden behind these different walls and different buildings. And that was very much where everyone hung out and swapped games and talked about what they were playing. And there was just a whole scene round about that experience.
I was wondering then, how did you like get the job at VIS? And you know, what was your kind of position and what were you initially doing?
So after I'd made that documentary, Fair Game, I started to think really seriously about designing games, and I'd had ideas previously when I'd been working with Jamie, and I put them down on paper and I started to take them to different people. I think I managed to get a meeting with Ubisoft, and I got a meeting with Philips at the time, who were making the CDI, if you might remember that wonderful platform. And the guy at Philips said to me, look, these are great and we like these ideas. How would you make them if you actually could? And I said, well, I don't really have any idea. So he said, well, there's this guy, Chris van der Kuyl in Dundee. He's got a game studio, you should go and see him. And I went to see Chris, and then we co-founded VIS together, and that was it. And Chris obviously had a lot of, I mean, Dundee's a small place, and Chris knew Dave, and Chris knew a lot of people that were working there. So we emerged as a sort of second tier of games developers out of Dundee at that time. And very quickly, you know, we'd signed our first game to Hasbro, and we were off and running.
Well, what did the concept of Head Extreme Destruction Zone come from? Can you give us a bit of background on that?
It was just called HEZ when we had it, but Hasbro didn't like the four-letter acronym, so they insisted that we add some text, HEZ Extreme Destruction Zone, to make it more, I guess, trademarkable. And, it was just, I've always kind of been interested in masks and African culture and just this whole idea. So it just, and this is before Pokemon even, so I think we were just looking for something that was kind of anarchic, but would allow people to have a really good multiplayer experience and then have lots and lots of different characterization for it. So HEZ seemed like an appropriate way to do it. And for anyone that doesn't know, the idea is that these aliens, they all look the same. They can travel through space and time, and they like to go and decapitate interesting characters from throughout space, time, and history. And then they put those different decapitated heads on site on top of their own, and they assume the personality and characteristics of that individual. And that was the basic plot of HEZ.
Where did that idea come from?
I don't know. Where does any good idea come from? Probably some combination of illicit behavior.
Well, it was the 90s, wasn't it?
It was exactly the 90s. And it feels like it's from the 90s. It really does. Yeah. And, I still really love the idea. I mean, it was hard for us when we had ambitions to go out there and, make a 3D arena fighter without any real experience in having built a game of that scale before. It was a couple of years of real graft. And I think that the truth is that HEZ didn't really work out to be the game that we'd all hoped, but it was an amazing learning experience for everybody involved. And, certainly a lot of the people then are still working in the industry today.
Now, the technology that was used on that game, I mean, what were you kind of making that 3D, the graphics on and rendering it? Did you have like expensive kit to do that on, or was it?
Yeah, no, we had Silicon Graphics machines, the big purple Graphics. And actually our lead, our CTO at the time had said, let's build them with voxels, right? So the plan was that we would get extra detail by producing these high quality 3D heads and then outputting them as voxels in the game. So when you look at them in the game, from a certain distance, they look absolutely fantastic. However, the problem with voxels, as it was then, when you get up close, it just looks like a blur of breakfast cereal. That was maybe one of the problems. Graphically, it didn't live up to the expectations. But overall, as I say, it was just an amazing experience.
And it had a really good, very interesting marketing campaign as well. I mean, were you involved in that much?
I wasn't involved in the marketing because it was mainly Hasbro that did that. But I do remember they had a launch party, which was just legendary at the time. And they flew a number of kind of waspish Americans over to the UK, and they let this woman in charge of the party. And I remember they had, it started off quite nice. There's like some Highland dancing, and then they brought on an extreme circus, and at one point I looked up and this dwarf guy was dragging a woman in a wheelchair by his penis across the dining room. Right? And I thought, okay, this has gone slightly differently from how I would expect it. And then next thing, we were outside at this fireworks display, and the fireworks were coming straight at people, and they were passing out, and it was screaming. And I thought, yeah, games industry is fun, right? This is kind of how it's meant to be. But I don't think any of them ever returned to Scotland again after that. They probably learned a lesson.
The 90s. Love it. Yeah. It was interesting. You guys did Earthworm Jim 3D as well. And at that time, there was a lot of transition of titles going from 2D to 3D. What was that process like?
Yeah, we met up with Shiny Entertainment, Dave Perry, the other Dave Perry, out in California, and managed to win the contract to make Earthworm 3D. And again, we had quite a lot of things going on in the studio at that point. We actually, I think we're still finishing off HEZ. So it was a lot to take on at that stage. And really just, I think the first year was just spent trying to get Jim to animate in 3D and, and work in a 3D environment in a correct way. So it was challenging just working within the parameters of Earthworm Jim himself. But then we just kind of went off on one, and I think we pretty much ignored all the advice and all the direction that we'd had from Shiny Entertainment, just made something of our own. And then about the last 6 months with Zen furiously trying to get us to retrofit things in that we'd missed out. So again, another kind of 90s experience, albeit built in the 2000s. But it was at that point, Mario 64 had hit the market as well. So we had this benchmark of like, this is what 3D games should look like. This is what people's expectations is going to be. And it was that's a high benchmark to live up to. So yeah, I think that was one of the more challenging things that we've ever done, just because it was right on that cusp of transition from 2D to 3D, as you say.
So many companies fell by the wayside during that kind of transition period.
Well, I think we brought down Interplay with that game because it's spent so much in money that there wasn't much left for anything else. So yeah, I'm possibly also responsible for bringing down Interplay Entertainment.
Nice. What was it like with that other titles coming out as well, when you saw stuff like Banjo and some of the stuff that was coming out of Rare?
Well, that's, I mean, Rare were all absolute heroes of mine, and I think all of those games, and we all know that the Bond game and Banjo, etc., were just fantastic games at the time. And I had the pleasure of kind of getting to know David Doak, who was one of the original team members down there, and we got down to them and visited the studio and talked a little bit about how they had built out Banjo. And I have absolute respect for them. I mean, they did have a little bit of help from Nintendo at the time, but honestly, these guys are kind of geniuses in their own lifetime, and certainly the kind of gaming that I'd always aspired to make.
We did mention earlier about that documentary that you made with Dominic Diamond, and that was the first time you met him. But how did that kind of lead to you appearing on Games Master then? What was the story there?
After I'd met Dominic and we did the documentary, we spent quite a lot of time in the car, driving around the country, talking about things, visiting these various locations. And I don't know, maybe he didn't really have any Scottish friends. Do you know what I mean? And he just thought, well, this would be cool. I can have a Scottish friend as well. So he liked me. And about 6 months after I'd done that documentary with him, he phoned me up and said, look, do you want to come down and spend some time in Games Master, maybe do some reviews? And again, typically I said yes, because I'm a yes person.
But I've got to ask your perspective on it then, because we've had Dominic on a couple of times. We've had Dave Perry on, Bandana Dave Perry, the games animal.
The other Dave Perry.
You were there, obviously, during the notorious Dave Perry Mario 64 incident.
I was very much
What happened from your perspective then? What memories have you got of that?
Well, I'm a sort of the patsy in all of this, because I didn't really know. I mean, I knew that there was some animosity between Dave and the production team. And, you know, Dave is an interesting character. He's charming, very charming on one hand, but he's also a bit of a tosser when he wants to be. So he had probably rubbed some people up, and I guess they decided that they would have a bit of fun with Dave over the Christmas quiz. But I was pretty much unaware of that, as I was most times I was on film, and they didn't really tell me much. They just kind of wheeled me out because I'm pretty. And got me to do, whatever they said. I didn't expect to be in the final of that quiz at all. Everybody else on the stage, whether it was Rick or Dave, really knows games. And I think their knowledge of games was far superior to mine. And if you go back through it, there's a couple of Earthworm Jim questions. And I was like, this is great, right? At least I'm getting something I can answer. And yes, I had played Mario 64, but not extensively, not kind of crazy times before that. And certainly I don't think I'm even a particularly good video games player. I'm not a games animal like David maybe is. But when it came to it, I think I won fair and square. It's just the rub of the dice. And for my money, Dave should not have jumped at the start, and that was his mistake, mate.
Was it awkward when the cameras stopped rolling?
It was really awkward, right? And there's a little bit after that where Dave storms out the studio and the cameras had stopped. And it wasn't. Yeah, at that point, no one felt good about it. And it did feel like a bit like a prank gone wrong. I can't believe that people are still talking about it 30 years later. I mean, it's just madness, isn't it? And I mean,
it's the most notorious Games Master moment, I think, isn't it?
It's just one of those sort of 90s moments that resonates in people's minds. And you know what it's like? If you were there, you were there. And even though Games Master, when you look back, I mean, a lot of it is pretty terrible, there is something really fond about it in my mind. And it still makes me chuckle to watch, all these days and read the comments from people. I love it. It's funny.
Did you watch the new version of it as well? And what did you think of that?
I did watch the new version. I don't really know what they're doing trying to bring it back. It doesn't seem like something that can exist in this time period. And I thought it was weirdly, like a lot of the elements were the same, but it just didn't really have that anarchy from the first one. So good as everybody is in respect to, everyone that was involved in it, but it wasn't for me.
Well, talking of anarchy, Dom and Kirk's Night of Plenty was a pretty interesting show. What was it kind of like working on that? And where did that idea come from?
Well, again, I mean, this all spills out of Games Master, really. Dominic was looking, and Dominic was, as a hardworking individual, so he was already looking at other things to do. And he came to me and said, look, there's an opportunity to work with Paramount Comedy. They have a slot, which is a late night slot on Tuesday. I think it was Wednesday evenings. And do you want to come down to London on Wednesdays and do like 3 hours live? And it's fine. We can go to the pub as well. And that's basically how that worked. So I would turn up on the flight. You know, I'd finished my sort of day job working on the games. I'd fly down to London. I'd go to the pub with Dominic. We'd both appear on the show pissed. He would take the mickey out of me, and then we'd go to the pub afterwards, and then he'd catch the first flight back to Scotland in the morning.
You know, speaking of, you mentioned the Dave Perry awkward moment. I imagine David Walliams' appearance on that was even more awkward.
I met David Walliams at a wedding, right? And, you know, I had never met him previously, but he was sitting opposite me at this wedding that I went to about 10 years afterwards. And I said, oh, hi, David, I'm Kurt. And he went, I know who you are. He's still holding a grudge about something that I wasn't even involved in all these years ago. Yeah, it's... I don't know. You know, people have their opinion about David Walliams. And I know Dominic certainly has one about him.
I was wondering how this and how you got kind of involved with Rockstar then.
So, well, I mean, we got involved with Rockstar when we pitched State of Emergency. I had met Sam briefly when he had been up visiting DMA, working on GTA. And he'd said, you know, please come to us. If you've got an idea, come to us. And we'd gone out to E3 that year. And we had a single sided printed sheet for State of Emergency. It's very simple. It just said, State of Emergency, the citizens are revolting, right? And on the back was a description of the game as it turned out to be. We went for a meeting before the show started with Sam and Dan, and they said, right, sign it. We'll sign it right here and there.
Well, you mentioned Eminem and GTA movie recently in the news. I mean, what's kind of the story there?
So that's a slightly different part of my career. So we worked on State of Emergency for Rockstar, and I got fairly close with Sam and the team at Rockstar in New York. I left Viz to pursue some other things. I ended up getting a job as an agent in London. I was working for this really quite famous American agency, ICM, in charge of film and game licenses and vice versa. I knew that there was only really one game worth its salt in terms of license in the world. So I knew. One day, Sam was up in Edinburgh. He was out with the Rockstar team, and I went down and waited at his hotel in the reception. And when he came back a bit piddled, we went up to the room, and we stayed up most of the night talking about what a GTA film could look like. And he said, fine, why don't you just represent it? And he signed over the rights to me for Grand Theft Auto, the movie, to which I then spent the next year and a half turning down offers that Sam didn't like from increasingly important film companies. To the point they eventually said, like, enough's enough. And that's how the Eminem thing came. I got a call one night from Scott Rudin, who's a legendary film producer in America. And he said to me, yeah, we've got an offer for you. It's a Paramount picture. It's a $5 million advance, Eminem to star in a Tony Scott film, Grand Theft Auto, the movie. So I went back to Sam and said, you know, this is the pitch from the studio. What do you think? And he said, Tony Scott, what about Ridley? Ridley too good for us. And he was joking, but at the same time, I knew right then and there that was kind of it. Rockstar probably weren't ever going to make a Grand Theft Auto movie. And they were right not to, because if you look at how the franchise evolved from that point on, it just feels like it would have trapped GTA in one, you know, celluloid moment, whereas it's much bigger as a game and everyone loves it much more as that kind of product.
What do you think it would have been like if Eminem starred in it? I mean, obviously he's known for being a rapper. Do you think he'd have done some of that? Would it have been a bit like 8 Mile kind of thing?
What do you reckon? Do you think he would have rapped? I think it would have been possible not to let out a couple of bars, right? So
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, maybe that film could have been good, and I don't think Tony Scott's a hack. I mean, you know, God rest his soul, he's not here, but you know, he made some good films at the moment, and Eminem was just coming off the back of 8 Mile, so he was riding high in terms of his performance career. It might have been okay, but it wouldn't have been our GTA. It would have been their GTA, and I think that's really what it is.
And to be fair, GTA is bigger than any movie these days, isn't it? It's not like it needed.
Absolutely. So yeah, we don't need.
Well, you mentioned State of Emergency there, and like it was a great concept for a game, you know, kind of anti-establishment, anarchistic title. Were there any ones that like influenced you, or any movies, or, you know, kind of cultural things?
I always say, and it's the truth, that the thing that really inspired State of Emergency was the Scottish poll tax riots back in the day when Thatcher imposed the poll tax on Scotland, and we all went out in the streets and demonstrated and marched and threw things around. And we had this idea that we wanted to do something about civil unrest and about having hundreds of characters on screen. I mean, that was really the goal, was to get hundreds of different characters all running around on a melee. So we knew what Grand Theft Auto was going to do. I may say, I don't think, you know, we weren't capable of building a game like that at that stage either as Viz. So we chose something that was a bit more anarchic, which was State of Emergency, the massively multiplayer beat 'em up, and off we went.
Yeah, there was that famous poll tax riot in London as well, where they smashed the whole of the kind of West End up in it.
That's the one. Yeah. That, I mean, the footage from that is still unbelievable. I mean, when Londoners riot, they really know how to do it, don't they?
I remember seeing footage of all these supercars destroyed, and then there was this one like hippie van, and then just left it like perfectly intact. Yeah,
one of us. Right, fair enough. No, I mean, it does come from that. And if you might remember, the State of Emergency also ended up in a really insane PR loop where when the game was announced, it was not long after the Seattle riots. So they started to look at us as being, you know, a developer that was using the Seattle riots as inspiration.
Yeah.
The fact that we'd been in development for 2 years prior to that.
So those were the WTO ones. And I was wondering, because this was actually brought up in America, I think it was in the Congress, but do you think that was an excuse for them to condemn it?
Congress was guns blazing for Rockstar at that point, I think, and Grand Theft Auto. You know, they had a real vendetta against anything that would be seen as this, you know, adult-orientated game. So State of Emergency just fell under the banner, and it just provided them a perfect excuse to have a go at us as well as the Rockstar guys. But certainly that was my baptism of fire for controversy in video games. And at that point, you know, going through that cycle, I really understood what push buttons, what to say, what not to say. I'm not sure I've ever learned what not to say, but implied. And so there was a whole other learning experience that happened from that went on to influence the way that I made games thereafter.
And famously, like GTA was, massively promoted by, I think it was Max Clifford at the beginning, to kind of whip up that controversy as well.
Well, I mean, Max Clifford, whatever you say about Max Clifford, and obviously he is a seedy individual, but he was good at his job, and he really, really upset the establishment with Grand Theft Auto, and I think paved the way. But this was the whole notion, like, you know, we were of that generation and that 90s generation that were saying, why can't we make games that we want to play? Why can't we make more adult style games? And then obviously once the cat was out of the bag, it just accelerated from that point on. But I mean, we were also, I mean, Viz were closely involved with another company called Stainless Games, who made Carmageddon on the Isle of Wight. And, you know, they were also trawling that kind of path with their game at the same time. And there was a few other people I knew, the Postal guys. So there was a kind of gang of us that were, you know, all pushing the boundaries of what was acceptable in gaming.
Do you think Rockstar were kind of testing the waters of controversy a bit with a State of Emergency for later titles that were going to come out?
I don't know if they were testing the waters necessarily, but they clearly understood that there was an audience and that they had a specific audience. So State of Emergency, you know, was a natural extension of the types of things they were doing. Sam had always been obsessed with The Warriors, the movie, and obviously went on to then make the game The Warriors, and as I think as a replacement in some ways for what State of Emergency failed to be. So Sam had a notion about these types of games and the type of settings that he wanted. State of Emergency fitted into that successfully, and that's why it got commissioned by Rockstar, I think, in the first place.
And how did multiplayer change the dynamic of that game, do you think?
Well, State of Emergency never had a proper multiplayer mode that I was satisfied with. And I think this is the great mistake of State of Emergency, because it was ideally for a multiplayer beat-em-up, you know, and shoot-em-up. That's what it was designed for. And, you know, sadly, the relationship with Rockstar ended at the end of the production of State of Emergency. I moved on from Viz. You know, they went on to make the second title, which, as you know, didn't quite work out either. And that was it. State of Emergency fell off the Rockstar roster. And it's a shame, because it was, I think it could have been a much better, longer-term franchise had we kept going with it.
What happened from your perspective there, then? Because I remember reading a lot about State of Emergency 2, and what kind of happened from your perspective then with all that?
I think Rockstar were disappointed ultimately with the game. It performed fine. It was number one in America for, you know, a number of weeks, etc. But it wasn't maybe as good as it could be. We had an interesting deal structure with Rockstar as well, in that we paid for the development of the game as Viz. So we actually got quite a high royalty back from the sales of the game as well, which helped us make a lot of money. And I think Sam wasn't particularly happy with that deal. So when it came time to renew, ways were parted because we couldn't agree on a new deal structure.
Do you think it's a title that might be revisited by Rockstar at one point?
No, I don't think it is, because I think that Rockstar make games that are originated by them and they're interested in original titles from them. State of Emergency is the last third-party title that Rockstar ever made, so there's another there's another accolade I can add to things, you know. Never stop any other developers from being commissioned by Rockstar Games.
Well, obviously, you know, you're no stranger to controversial games. Where did the concept of JFK Reloaded come from?
I think I've got a pretty good handle on when I started thinking about JFK as well. And it was during the making of State of Emergency. State of Emergency took years, 3 years over to make. It was, you know, all my developments mainly have had problems one way or the other. It says something about my skills as a designer. But at the time, we spent so long working on State of Emergency and working on these huge maps and trying to build everything out, that I started to think about, wouldn't it be more interesting or interesting to look at a moment in time rather than these kind of more expansive games? And I started to think about, well, what moment in time would that be? And, you know, variously I worked through like the moon landing. Maybe you could land on the moon and you could sort of bounce around for a while. And none of these seemed to have the right qualities that I wanted to get seen. So I stumbled across the idea of doing JFK. And I thought about the ballistics and I looked at the information that was there available from the day. And I realized, well, this actually, you know, from a documentary perspective, there's so much data about what happened, the wind speed, the ballistics drop off, etc., that there's something in this. And I started to think, right, okay, JFK is the perfect moment to go back and explore. And also at the same time, I was slightly dismissive of conspiracy theories and, you know, some of the hype round about, say, like the JFK movie. And I thought, there's another way that we can do this, and we can take our games technology and apply it to a subject like JFK.
Well, interestingly as well, that was developed under the Carmageddon engine. So how did that kind of help develop the title?
How did you know that? I've never said that publicly.
I saw it online.
Well, as I'd mentioned, I did have a good relationship with some of the developers that had worked on that. So I had a bunch of really brilliant physics programmers that understood what I was trying to achieve and were happy to come along on that ride.
I do remember, you know, the press and the statements around the game back in the day. I remember a spokesman for Ted Kennedy said the game was despicable, and there were senators who were sickened by the game as well. I mean, do you remember the big uproar around that title then, and what did you kind of think of it?
When we were launching JFK Reloaded, I phoned up Sam and said, look, I think there might be some controversy about this. So do you have any good recommendations of a PR manager that I could work with that could help me manage it? And he put me in touch with this guy who shall remain nameless again, but he was a sort of PR troubleshooter, and he would call me from the deck on his ranch out in Texas. And he said to me, he said, Kirk, this is a controversial title. He said, not everyone's going to like this title. He said, but here's how it's going to go down. I'm going to get you an interview with Newsweek, with Engai Kroll, who's the lead technology writer. And if Engai likes it, then he'll write a story. And if he writes a story, you'll be on the Today Show on Wednesday. And Engai liked it. And I ended up on the Today Show on Wednesday, being chauffeured around New York, doing all of these different crazy interviews. And it just went off from there. So, you know, being involved in that news cycle, again, I understood this is probably not going to last forever, but it was fairly intense at the time because people were literally sort of calling for my death, blaming me directly for the death of Kennedy.
Is it true that you got death threats from the...
Very much so. I mean, quite explicit death threats as well. I mean, I didn't know you could do these things to people, but... And from all corners. I mean, I had a reverend in the Deep South in America call me a purveyor of electronic wickedness, which was a T-shirt that I should always have had made.
Interestingly, you had a competition in it as well, which was,
that really wasn't such a great idea in retrospect.
Yeah, you can win money for whoever recreates the assassination.
It was actually more scammy than that, if you remember, because it was you can win up to $100,000, but the up to was an important part. And what I did was I'd basically set aside money for development. So I was like, right, well, once we reach this target and everyone gets paid, then we'll put all the money, you know, like a 50% of the money that we get from that into the prize pot. But the game never really made any money. I think we probably broke even roundabout, and I actually had to still pay out €20,000 to some guy who won the competition. So it was a bad day for me all round, because I'd made this outrageous claim. I got really harassed about it in the press, and then I actually still had to give someone the money.
Well, some fans were suggesting interesting ideas for games as well. And
I've heard some of them before.
Yeah. Diana one was one which popped up. Were there ideas that you thought this was kind of going to go too far and that you wouldn't go down those roads?
It's pretty interesting that you mentioned Diana, because I got that a lot at the time. And sometimes it was people being helpful with a suggestion, like, hey, what about a Diana game? And sometimes it was them mocking you, going like, well, why not just make a Diana game if that's the kind of person that you are? Here we are 20 years later. I still sort of think that Diana thing would make a good game, if I'm perfectly honest. And I've done, you know, a fair amount of research on it. And I think there's enough information, you know, for that missing, 13 seconds inside the tunnel to go and explore that and say, well, what would have happened if the, you know, paparazzi outriders had run into the car? What would happen if this guy had been drunk beyond his limits? So playing with parameters within the context of what we know to see how the actual event played out from a sort of creative perspective and a documentarian perspective, I think it's completely valid. Would it ruffle feathers still? Yes, remarkably, people can't let it go. So we can do what we want with the crown, but we're not allowed to do anything in video game format. So it's interesting that you mentioned that Diana idea, because I think it's actually pretty valid.
Yeah, I went to Dismaland. I went to Dismaland, and that was at the centerpiece of Banksy's Princess Castle as well.
Well, so he's exchanged it to a bit of control. Yeah.
It's very interesting. But I was wondering, do you think like any of these titles that you did back then would get more of a reaction nowadays?
I'm really not sure. I mean, you know, JFK aside, because JFK was made by me and a bunch of guys, so we can do what we want. We published online. We don't need a publisher. We don't need anybody to tell us what to do. And I think that's still one of the positive things about, you know, the PC scene and this indie scene, that they can still go and find innovation. But I don't think the subject matters would be as popular nowadays as they were back then. Maybe it was just of its moment, and now we have to look at something different.
Well, I know you're still very much involved in the industry, and you've got some exciting projects that you're working on these days. We kind of hinted at the beginning that, you know, you're kind of sticking it to the big tech companies in America, which, you know, we're big fans of as well. So what are you up to these days, then? Anything you can talk about that you've got coming up?
I just want to point out that I've sucked plenty of corporate tea over the years, so I'm not a complete punk renegade in every form. You know, I've taken Audi's money. I've taken money from all sorts.
We think you're cool, Kirk. Don't worry.
It's not a unique thing. But I guess, you know, it's interesting because there's a parallel with what I did with Heads and what I went on to do with my company Vimy. So we got involved in PlayStation Home, the much derived PlayStation Home, and built a lot of content for that over the years. And I got really into this whole sort of avatar world and virtual world sort of setup. And you know, we sold a lot of, we made a lot of custom clothing and a lot of sort of designs for people's avatars. And this idea of sort of masking yourself came back to the fore. But from that Vimy project, I actually started to get involved in augmented reality, and I formed another company with some colleagues, 11 years ago now, called Zapper. And Zapper we have our own technology stack, our own tools, our own vision algorithm. We make everything for augmented reality. And just this year, we're launching a mixed reality headset of our own. It's derived from Google Cardboard, so it's still one that you put your phone in, but it comes with controllers like Quest and so on. And it's $80, and we like to think that it's better than Meta, is the slogan that we're using right now. And just anything that sort of disrupts the industry in one form or another is always still interesting to me.
Do you think there's more areas to kind of explore and, you know, expand gaming experiences in VR and AR?
I've enjoyed designing in mixed reality so much. You know, it was a complete new canvas. And to have other people in different locations, but in your room, sort of looking at game components and moving them around has been an amazing experience. So just from a sort of design perspective, it's been a completely new challenge to build in it. And I think there are loads of things that we can do in mixed reality that we haven't seen in normal gaming before. I mean, there's still lots of tech. It's incredible, guys. You know, the same things that I was playing on the Amiga are still valid in terms of how gameplay works. The core of games is pretty set. So we're looking at the same sort of techniques, but it's how it can be implied. And I think that when you're in your environment, what I'm really interested in is like, how can we actually involve the other things round about you in your room and then bring that into the gaming as well? So there's definitely possibilities for mixed reality and these types of things that didn't exist before in the other platforms.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the Amiga there. We were, do you remember those old virtuality headsets?
Yeah.
From the early 90s? Yeah, we were. There's a couple of those at the Retro Computing Museum in Leicester, and we had a bit of a play with them, and they've actually got Amigas inside them. They were powered by Amigas.
Amazing.
3,000 strapped to your back. quite an experience.
It's one of those things, isn't it? I mean, we were promised virtual reality a lot for a number of years.
Yeah.
And I think when I first put on the Quest 2, I really did think, okay, this is it, right? You know, they've reached a consumer-ready headset. But I suffer from the same thing that I think other people do, which is that after a while, I'm just a bit like, I don't know if I want to be in this thing anymore. It's too discombobulating. It makes you feel a little bit weird. So even though I'm playing Half-Life, Alex, I'm like, I don't want to spend that much time in it. So it's not got that same addiction power that the early video games did, where you just didn't want to leave.
Yeah, because I mean, I've got a PSVR and I've got a Quest 2 as well. And like, they both gather dust a lot of the time. It's just, I don't know why it is though. I always think, I mean, I think the Quest is an easier device to use than something like the PSVR, where you've got bloody cables halfway across the room.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
You know, but I don't know if it's just like, if my wife's in the room, I feel a bit antisocial putting it on.
I
think, you know.
Something about putting a headset on that always makes me feel like my mum's going to walk in and be having a wank. You know, it's got that. It's just got that I shouldn't really be in here doing this feeling to it. So yeah, that's why I think that mixed reality for me appeals a lot more, because you've got a sense that you're still in the real space, but hey, there's all this other graphic action happening.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great point to end on there, Kirk. That was a fascinating look back at your career. I wish you luck with that as well. When's that the headset going to be out then? Is it going to be
headset
this year?
Launches on the 2nd of April.
Anywhere that we can find that information on that?
You can just search for Zapbox on the internet and you will find out all about it.
Brilliant. Now, well, listen, mate, thank you so much for sharing some of your memories with us, and best of luck with it.
Thank you for leading me down memory lane, guys. Much appreciated. It's nice to talk to you.